How terrifying. It's very easy standing in front of a camera because I can't see any of you. So when it actually comes to not having the camera there, it's like looking into a small box which is full of people. I just wanted to talk about three things this afternoon. First of all, they are what I'm calling a spiritual renaissance that's taking place all across the planet, and I'll speak a little bit about that. Then I'm going to read a couple of sections from a book from a spiritual ecologist called Joanna Macy. And that will be really, she's trying to set the scene for where we are now as a human race, what point we have reached, and where perhaps we might be going. Does that make any sense? Kind of. Okay. Then I'll have a couple of observations on that, and then I'll read a Tibetan Buddhist prophecy to finish with. Does that sound okay? Okay. I'm a parish priest. I'm looking after three tiny little parishes near Brighton in Sussex. And I arrived there 7.5 years ago. And I'm a non-stipendary minister, which means I don't get paid. The church very kindly give me a house, and I sort of make my way from there. In the time that I've been living near Lewes and Brighton, I've met an extraordinary group of people. This group of people believe that humanity now stands at a crossroads. That's all of us. It is a place that we have not stood since the beginning of the agricultural revolution 10,000 years ago. And the ideas and the decisions that we will make over the next 50 years will completely define our future. In one way, we are blessed to be here now on this planet at this time. But that carries with it, for each one of us, huge responsibilities about the decisions we make and the type of world that we leave our children and our grandchildren. It is not business as usual, as it has been for the human race for perhaps the last 500 or 600 years. We are approaching a time of profound and radical change. The group of human beings that I hang out with around Brighton and Lewes will talk openly about this change. They will say, we are in a period of spiritual renaissance with immense spiritual potential and a spiritual energy being garnered and given now, once again, to human beings. It's an incredibly exciting time. And I agree with them. I'm a Christian priest, and I agree that we are at this crossroads. You do not hear this conversation taking place within Christian circles, within Christendom itself. And I would like to explore why that is the case. We are the biggest religion on the planet, Christianity, and yet we seemed completely disengaged at the moment from the spiritual realities that are shaping our future. Why has this happened? First of all, I just want to read a little from this book by Joanna Macy called Active Hope. She identifies three particular ways of thinking that we have all absorbed. And I'd like, if you will, for all of you just to bear with me while we go through these three positions, these three human identities, these three places where we might see ourselves. The first of these stories, the first of these narratives, is called Business as Usual. This is the story told by most mainstream policymakers and corporate leaders. Their view is that economies can and must continue to grow, even in the face of economic downturns and periods of recession, the dominant assumption is that it won't be long before things pick up again. Expressing his trust in the path of economic growth in November 2010, President Obama said the single most important thing we can do is to reduce our debt and deficits, and then is to start to grow. For a market economy to grow, it needs to increase sales. That means encouraging all of us to continually buy and consume more than we already do. Advertising plays a key role in stimulating consumption, and increasingly children are targeted as a way of boosting each household's appetite for goods. In this country, every child under the age of 14 grows up watching over 25 television commercials a year. When you're living in the middle of this story, and we all are living in the middle of this story, it's easy to think of it as just the way things are. Young people may be told there is no alternative but to find their place in this scheme of things. Getting ahead is presented as the main plot, supported by subplots of finding a partner, fending for your family, looking good, and buying stuff. In this view of life, the problems of the world are seen far away and irrelevant to the dramas of our personal lives. The second story is called The Great Unraveling. In 2010, polls for both CBS and Fox News showed that a majority believed the conditions for the next generation, that's all of our children, would be worse for people living today. 2 years earlier, an international poll of more than 61,000 people in 60 countries yielded similar results. With so many people losing confidence that things will be okay, a very different account of events is now emerging. Since it involves a perception that our world is now in serious decline, we take a term used by a social thinker, David Corton, and we call this story The Great Unraveling. In our work with people addressing their concerns about the world, we're struck by how many issues are triggering alarm. And it is these issues that are triggering alarm. Economic decline, resource depletion, climate change, social division and war, and the mass extinction of species. I'll just talk a little bit about the mass extinction of species, because this is happening now. This is happening under the watch, and has been happening under the watch of the great monotheistic religions, which we're all a part of. With rising pollution, habitat destruction, and the disturbance wrought by climate change, the toll on wildlife has been enormous. A third of all amphibians, at least a fifth of all mammals, and an eighth of all bird species are now threatened with extinction. One writer has recently called this that humanity is on a collision course with catastrophe. What that means is that we now face a double reality. The stories of business as usual and the great unraveling offer starkly contrasting accounts of the state of our world. They are two different realities coexisting at the same time and space. You probably know people who live in a different story than you do. You may also be moving between stories yourself. It's possible to spend part of the day in our business as usual model, making plans for a future we assume will be much like today, and then something triggers an awareness of the mess we're in. And we recognize deep within our hearts and minds that for all of us, there is a huge crash that is coming. For increasing numbers of people, this crash has already arrived. Homes flooded, farms abandoned, water supplies contaminated. The mainstream reality of business as usual is increasingly becoming interrupted by the bad news of the great unraveling. When we first become aware of the grimness of our situation, It can come as quite a shock. Most of these issues, as you all I know, have probably clocked. Most of these issues are squeezed out of all the mainstream media. And you can only find them mentioned in fringe publications. The gaze of the modern press, particularly in the Western world, is more focused on economics and gossips about celebrity. When these issues do come up in conversation, they're often met by an awkward silence, the awkward silence I'm facing right now. The two different views commonly block the flow of words. The first dismisses the problem as completely overblown. Oh, there's nothing to worry about. This is the voice of the first story, and everything's not really as bad as you're making it out to be. The second perspective fully inhabits this time, this great unraveling. And this view sees continued decline as so inevitable as to render it not worth talking about. There is resigned acceptance that things have gone too far, and that we can't do anything about them, and that we've crossed a point of no return. The third story is the great turning. In the agricultural revolution of 10,000 years ago, the domestication of plants and animals led to a radical shift in the way people lived. In the Industrial Revolution that began just a few hundred years ago, a similar dramatic transition took place. These weren't just changes in the small detail of people's lives. The whole basis of society was transformed, including, critically, people's relationship with one another and with this beautiful planet that we share. Right now, a shift of comparable scope and magnitude is occurring. We are at the beginning of what is called the ecological revolution, the sustainability revolution, the necessary revolution. And this is the third story. It's called the Great Turning, and we see it as an adventure, the essential adventure of our time, which all of us are now intimately involved in. In the early stages of major transitions, the initial activity might seem to only exist at the fringes. Yet when their time comes, ideas and behaviors become contagious. The more people pass on inspiring perspectives, the more these perspectives catch on. At a certain point, the balance tips and we reach a critical mass. Don't be surprised if you have not read about this transition in the newspapers and seen it reported in other mainstream media. Their focus is usually trained on sudden, discrete events they can point their cameras at, and I know that. Cultural shifts, the one in which we are all now involved in, happen on a different level. They come into view only when we step back enough to see a bigger picture, the picture that's been changing slowly over time. Does that make sense? Yeah. Are you with me? Okay. Two questions. Firstly, where are you standing? Where are you standing in this great question of our age? This great crossroads? Where are you? What is your story? Are you part of the business as usual model? Are you part of the great unraveling, seemingly looking at a future that is utterly without hope? Or are you part of the great turning, imagining a future that can work? Where are you? And secondly, where is Christendom? Where is Christianity placed within that set, those sets of criteria? Where is Christianity within those sets of criteria? Where we are perhaps is going to have a great deal to do with where we are spiritually, religiously, and where for us do we behold our sense, our intimate experience of the sacred. What Joanna Macy doesn't mention is the connection between anthropocentric, human-centered, Christianity and the rise of the individual. The Christian faith is primarily concerned with human beings, each one of us, you and I. It deals with our propensity for sin and our capacity to perfect ourselves through the grace of God and the action and reality of the Holy Spirit. And it's a beautiful ideal. And this contact with God, I have no doubt in my heart, is what opens us, is what stills us, is what illuminates us, and provides us with the rock from which we can become more loving, more generous, more open human beings. And Christ talked about this experience when he said, "I have come that you should have life in its fullness," that we should experience through the presence of God in our lives the wonder, the sheer sensual wonder of being human. Christianity, therefore, as it has been expressed since the Reformation, is largely dealing with our relationship with other human beings and how those relationships are conducted as the stuff of Christianity. It still is. It still is. When we look at the live issues within Christianity at the moment, they are all about human identity, human relationships, the ordination of women. Still, why are we talking about this? And homosexuality. It's like a record that's got stuck. And the debate surrounding the Occupy movement was predicated on justice. Is it right that some human beings should have access to greater amounts of wealth than others? What struck me about the Occupy movement was that it demonstrated where the lines are within both the church and the public understanding of Christianity. But in all this talk of justice, justice for the poor, justice for the bereaved, there was not one word uttered on the steps of St. Paul about justice for the planet, justice for the environment, justice for the natural world. If there ever was a point where you could see right into the eyes of the church, it was then. And if you looked hard, you could see a dreadful truth, and it is this: that Christianity in the West, with its emphasis on human-centered spirituality, really fostered and gave birth to individualism, and individualism spawned capitalism. I don't like it any more than you do. It was not that the church has not responded to the young people on the steps of St. Paul. It is just that from where it is right now, which is essentially where it has been since the Reformation, it cannot respond. It could not respond because it is rooted in the business as usual model. It has occasionally scolded, but it has really gone along with it, because I would imagine the cost of questioning it, let alone standing up against it, would be like publicly denouncing your own children. Anthropocentric Christianity has in the West essentially licensed capitalism, and it is capitalism that is taking us to the brink of environmental and social meltdown. And I just ask you, all of you, to have the courage to face what we have coming. I know it's not easy, but we have to be real about it. We have to be real about where we are. The major casualty of capitalism has been the natural world around us. We are in a state of war with the natural world. And we have been since we developed the weapons with which we have laid and are laying waste to it as I speak. I love the strapline to this festival, saving paradise. No, really, I do. But we have to reach the point when we realize we cannot save paradise, not until we understand that it is paradise that continually saves us. Christ was a teacher of consciousness. He was not a teacher of religion. He was trying to lead us to a place where we could see and hear the being of God, where we could see paradise, hear paradise. Look, he said, look at the lilies of the field. And here he was talking about wildflowers. I tell you, not even King Solomon in all his finery is dressed as one of these. Hear it, hear it. We cannot save paradise until we can feel it, until we are reduced to tears by the sheer beauty and wonder of this world that we live in. It is extraordinary. And I've seen quite a lot of it now. That the buttercup is loved beyond measure. We cannot save paradise until we consecrate every flower, every wave, each drop of rain, until we know each one of them as an intimate prayer in themselves. When we bless the flies, we enter paradise. When we know each day as a gift, we enter paradise. We enter paradise when we lie in the arms of the one we love and know that moment as prayer, not profanity. We're approaching the time of year when Christianity celebrates the giving of the harvest. And since the Second World War and the advent of current farming practices, the butterfly population in the fields beyond this festival have been reduced by 87%. Wild bird populations have also seen a catastrophic decimation of their kind. The trouble with these figures is that we see them as isolated statistics. They are national. But when you add all those national statistics of species decline together, as the United Nations have done, the picture that is revealed of the natural world is one of devastation. The United Nations have said, we now stand on the brink of the sixth mass extinction of species in the history of this planet. We are living in these times. The process of mass extinction is taking place now. Each one of us is intimately involved in this as long as we choose to live in a manner that supports the destruction of the natural world. Each one of us takes part in that destruction. And at the root of this is our human identity. What it is and how it is to be a human being. And we've inherited this identity from our fathers and our mothers, and they have inherited it from our ancestors. And at the moment, it is acceptable to be a Christian whilst also following a lifestyle that is responsible for the decimation of the natural world. We need to be real about the fact that this process, this unraveling, is taking place under the watch of Christianity, that there are now currently over 16,000 species which face extinction as a direct result of my behavior, of your behavior. In a couple of Sundays' time, churches up and down the country will be singing, "We plow the fields and scatter the good seed on the land." And as long as we continue to dance to this tune, the destruction will continue. The reason why religion and food are so intimately connected is because the relationship between the food we eat and the manner in which we are treating this planet is umbilical. And currently, the manner in which we are celebrating the production of that food is responsible for the ongoing decimation of the natural world. I will do one more. And after that, I am doing no more harvest festivals, as long as we continue to behave in this manner. The harvest festival is the main interface between the Christian tradition and the natural world. At this point, the Christian tradition, I'm afraid, runs out of words. We have no Torah. We have no map with which to find our way into this relationship. And at this point, we all need to take a step into a new world now. All of us collectively have to accept responsibility and to imagine what it might be to be a Christian, understanding those responsibilities. Christianity is, I feel, the seminal religion of love, and I've seen a lot of them. The reality of Christ consciousness is love, beautiful love. And the new religious paradigm, which I mentioned at the beginning, this spiritual renaissance, which is filling my head and my heart, has at its heart the reality that we, all of us, live in a community. The planet is a community of life. No religion will survive the next millennia unless it embraces and celebrates that community, that reality. No religion will survive. We are it, and it is us. One life carrying all life, and all life carrying one life. That is the new spiritual paradigm. The treasure in the field, Christ's parable, the treasure in the field that Christ speaks of, is not gold or silver. It is the field itself. It is seeing what is there as treasure, seeing it with eyes that behold the wonder and sheer majestic beauty that is life on this earth. Once you have seen life with those eyes, you see yourself in the same way. This realization that Christ speaks of when he talks about God's love for the sparrows then goes on to say, how much more will God love you? How much more will God love us human beings? He is not saying that we are loved more than the sparrows. He is saying that we can know that love more completely. With consciousness comes awakening. Once we have seen the treasure before us, we can never be the same again. Are Christians to be part of the system that is currently eradicating and destroying so much of life on this beautiful planet? Or are we to become guardians and nurturers? This is the biggest question that we face. Are we to be part of a system that is currently eradicating and decimating life on this planet? Or are we to become guardians and nurturers? At the heart of the Christian tradition is the act of communion. Communion takes bread and wine, the fruits of the earth. It is a fusion of spirit and flesh. Take, eat. This is my body. I am the earth. I am the seed. I am the rain. I am the sun. I am the wheat. I am the grapes. I am the bread. I am the wine. Remember what I am. And when you get this, you become like me, knowing. You are the earth. You are the seed. You are the rain. You are the sun. You are the wheat. You are the bread. You are the wine. A final word from this extraordinary book. It's a 12th century. It's a 12 centuries old Tibetan Buddhist prophecy. And it was spoken to the author of this book, Joanna Macy. I'm going to read it to you. There comes a time when all life on earth is in danger. At that time, great powers have arisen, barbarian powers. And although they waste their wealth in preparations to annihilate one another, they have much in common. Among the things they have in common are weapons of unfathomable destructive power and technologies that lay waste to the world. It is just at this point in our history when the future of all beings seems to hang by the frailest of threads that the kingdom of Shambhala emerges. You can't go there because it's not a place. It exists in the hearts and the minds of Shambhala warriors. You can't tell whether someone is a Shambhala warrior just by looking at him or her, because these warriors wear no uniforms or insignia. They have no banners to identify whose side they're on, no barricades with which to climb or to threaten the enemy, or behind with which to rest and regroup. They don't even have any home turf. The Shambhala warriors have only the terrain of the barbarian powers to move across and act on. Now the time is coming when great courage is required of the Shambhala warriors, moral and physical courage. That is because they are going to go right into the heart of the barbarian powers to dismantle their weapons and their citadels where the weapons are made and deployed. The Shambhala warriors know these weapons can be destroyed because they are manamaya, which means they are just mind-made. They are made by the human mind and thus can be unmade by the human mind. The dangers facing us are not brought on by some satanic deity or some evil extraterrestrial force or by some unchangeable preordained fate. Rather, these dangers arise out of our relationships and habits, out of our priorities. So, said the Buddhist monk, now is the time. Now is the time for the Shambhala warriors to go into training. How do they train? Joanna Macy asked. They train by using two implements, the Buddhist monk said. What are they? Joanna Macy asked. And he held up his hands in the way the dancers hold up the ritual objects in the great Lama dances of his people. One, he said, is compassion. The other is insight into the radical interdependence of all beings. You need both. You need compassion because it provides the fuel to move you out to where you need to be and to do what you need to do. It means not being afraid of the suffering of your world. And when you're not afraid of the world's pain, then nothing can stop you. But by itself, that implement, compassion, is very hot. It can burn you out. So you need the other tool, the insight into the radical interdependence of all that is. When you have that, then you know that this is not a battle between the good guys and the bad guys. You know that the line between good and evil runs through the landscape of every human heart. And you know that we are so interwoven in the web of life that even our smallest acts have repercussions that ripple through the whole web, beyond even our capacity to see them. So what are we to be? What are we to be? Thank you. Apparently there's a little time for some questions, if any of you would like to ask questions. Have I shared this with my parishioners? Yes, I have. I get the reaction of how it makes you feel to hear that. I don't know the reaction I get. I can only, you have to tell me of the reaction it gives you.
It makes me feel really sad when it's so lovely that so many people here, all ages, but there are many people that this just seems just irrelevant to them.
It's not irrelevant to anybody, my darling. It intimately involves each one of us, every single human being on the planet. It's just whether we choose to face that right now. It's not easy to face, but it involves all of us, young, old, Hindu, Jain, Christian, Buddhist, Muslim. It involves all of us now. It's about how we are to be human. What it is to be a human being. This is the great question we face. Now, it was the great question that Christ addressed. It was the great question that the Buddha addressed. It was the great question that Muhammad addressed. But those were different times. These are our times now. And we need to be bold enough to own up to the fact that this is the world we have created and this is where we are.
Okay, we've got another question down here.
Hello. I share your concerns that we don't live sustainably, and I think you have delivered a powerful tirade against what society does. But one of the things you haven't articulated is an answer, and I would invite you to agree with me that we each of us need to live in a more sustainable fashion and reflect upon the consequences of our actions. And would you agree with me that that's the underlying message of what you're saying to us?
I would agree completely with you. We have to live in the full glare that we are interdependent beings. I cannot function as a human being without the grass doing what the grass does, without the trees doing what the trees do, without the fruit-producing plants. I cannot function. Christianity has traditionally push them aside and said, no, 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 it is you, it is I, as human beings, that contain the divine imperative. I'm saying, when Christ said, love your neighbor as yourself, the time has now come for Christianity to extend their vision, that love, to all life, and to accept responsibility that that is the final destination of that particular vision. I can't tell people, and I'm not going to tell people, what that will mean for them. I can only invite you to become fully aware of the fact that we live in a beautiful interdependent system.
Okay, thank you.
I completely agree with what you've been saying about the interdependence.
I can't see you, I'm so sorry.
Over here, okay. I and my family make our living growing vegetables organically, and we can only do that because we have a heavily subsidised cottage. Yeah. We couldn't possibly do it if we had to pay market rent. That's just one sort of aside. And in our tiny North Oxfordshire village, which is not exactly a heartland of sort of environmental activism, Harvest Festival is a chance to reconnect people who might not otherwise have an awful lot to do with green issues with where their food is coming from. And yeah, chuck out the sterile service with the tins of spaghetti and so on. Visit the allotments. You know, don't do away with Harvest Festival. Make it a true celebration of what's got, you know, I know the area around Lewis. There are plenty of people growing things. Get out there and take your parishioners with you. Don't give up the Harvest Festival.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. What I'm asking, what I'm asking for is for Christianity to be honest about what it is celebrating. Yes, of course, I want to celebrate food that is produced lovingly and beautifully. But really, you're an organic farmer. You know the reality of the situation. that the vast majority of our food is not produced in that way. And as long as we just numbingly go along with harvest festivals as they are, we're reinforcing that model which is effectively proving to be so toxic. And we need to step back and say, actually, as a Christian, I cannot celebrate that anymore. I can celebrate the manner in which people mindfully and lovingly produce our food, but I cannot celebrate a system that is in the process of destroying much of the life around me. It's a hard choice, but we have to be real about that.
I absolutely agree, but it doesn't have to be all one or all the other. You know, another thing that is really quite meaningful in our tiddly little parish church, we walk around the Rogation Sunday. We have a village of 60 households.
Sure.
And in that village, actually, the three things that generate any income actually in the village are all to do with horticulture.
Sure.
And there is stuff going on, and people, most of the time, they're just in their cars driving off to Sainsbury's or whatever, and they don't realise. And there are points in our Christian calendar that we can use as hooks without being unreal and going along with what's always been done. In the past, those things were there for a reason. They've become part of the Christian calendar because they meant something when they arose, and they still can mean something if we, you know, agree. We need to challenge the way it's been done for the last umpty years. But we can use Rogation and Plough Sunday and all the rest of it as hooks to reconnect people to the reality of where their food comes from and how important it is.
Thank you.
Peter, thank you. It was a passionate plea for the planet. And what you have said is the answer. We have all to fall in love with what's around us. Love your neighbour as yourself. Yes. Our neighbours are the plants. Our neighbours are the trees. Our neighbours are human beings.
Yes.
And love is the answer.
Yes,
love is at the centre of the universe.
Yes,
and you have given us a real encouragement to be passionate, to go out there and to love what we have.
Yes.
Because it's being destroyed. Let's love one another. Let's love our neighbours. And thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Last one.
Peter, thank you again. Thank you very much. You asked where we are. I move between all three. I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, sure.
Sometimes I just want the world to go on as it is and pretend nothing's happening. Sometimes I despair, it's all unravelling. And sometimes I want to turn it around. And thank you for inspiring me. The thing I'd like to add is I'm a parish priest. I have real foibles about Harvest Festival. And you've encouraged me to say something different this year and be more honest than I have been. Thank you for that. But I learn a lot from my pagan friends, from my Hindu friends. So it's not, you know, it's very easy to say, well, what can we, the church, do for others? Well, one thing we do is shut up and listen.
Yeah, thank you.
And we can actually say, we haven't got it right all the time.
No, we haven't.
And let's do this together. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, everyone. I hope you have a fantastic rest of your greenbelt.